And so
I've always been purple. I'm very purple.
Yes.
So guys, I'm very excited. We're going to be speaking in a few minutes with Lucy Flores, who will be coming on. And for people who don't remember Lucy Flores, will you look up what her current title is now? Like, I know that, but Lucy Flores is the woman who was running for lieutenant governor of Nevada and was speaking at an event at which
she was a former assemblywoman.
Nevada. But this is the woman that was prior to going up and giving a speech during a campaign for running for lieutenant governor. Then Vice President Joe Biden came up behind her, put his hands on his shoulders, sniffed her hair, and kissed her on the back of the head. And I remember this when this happened, by the way. I remember this, and I was livid. And I remember so many people being like, it's just the way he is. It's just, it was just nice. He's like an old grandpa. He's like a father. This entitlement. I do not care. Yes, there is a spectrum between things like this and what happened to Tara Reid. There is a spectrum, but this is disgusting. Go up to a person that you put hands and mouth on somebody you don't know. It's disgusting. So I was outraged. I thought everybody downplayed it. And anyway, and because everybody was so harsh on Lucy Flores, that was what inspired Tara Reid to come forward and tell her story, because it bothered her that Lucy Flores was getting so much flack for telling her story. Speaking of which.
And I do think that contact? Yeah, if
I don't have a contact other than the email.
Just email. Yeah. Okay. So we're waiting right now on Lucy. So hopefully it won't be too much longer. But yeah, I think that that's... I think it also speaks to a bigger issue here when it comes to, you know, the what is considered acceptable behavior by people in power. And you saw what happened with Time's Up. You know, that's another example of the way that these men get protected, particularly President Biden and Senator, Governor Cuomo, no longer governor.
This went to her today.
Yeah.
All right. So that's all I can do.
Let me see that email again.
It's whatever the one you had.
Yeah, that's
correct. Okay. It came up automatically because you had already typed the email to her.
Well, we always make sure to say Eastern Standard Time.
I do.
Yes.
I always say Eastern Standard Time because we do have West Coast friends. And every once in a while, somebody from Australia might pipe in, or Ireland. You never know.
Yeah. No. And again, I think that
we're so international here. So I am looking forward to speaking with her. I always... found that story not just credible, but outrageous. And it was completely offensive to me that it was underreacted to in the way that it was. And this was back when Joe was vice president. It wasn't even he was having to challenge Donald Trump, and we had to all just overlook that, you know, you're a little rapey. We have to put that aside in for the greater picture. This wasn't even then. This was before that. It's just gross, people.
And I also think that this gets back to what may have happened when it did happen, and the way that she probably tried to reach out to, you know, people and say, look, this happened. It was not good. You know, what should I do? And I think the response she probably got was one that basically suggested, oh, that's Joe. It's not a big deal. That's just how he is. And people thinking that that's okay. And it's not okay.
Oh, she's on the Google thing. Oh, okay. Hold on a second. Let me tell her what happened.
You sent her the wrong thing?
No, she's just on the where you sent her the calendar date. She clicked on that.
Oh, okay. All right. So I messed up, I guess. Well, I sent
No.
Okay.
So that's why. All right. She'll be here in a second. She clicked on the, you sent her the Google Meet, and so you can click on the calendar thing and go into meetings. And then she didn't check that I sent her a follow-up email.
Yeah. And again,
okay. So hopefully this gets rectified in a few minutes.
But again, as I said, I think, and this is sort of the story that you guys have been seeing with R. Kelly and what he had been able to get away with for so long. I know that everybody is all about it's the perpetrator. It's that person. But I come from the school of thought that the enablers are just as bad, if not worse, because they know what's going on. And they deliberately hide it for whatever reasons there may be. It could be ambition. It could be code of silence, whatever it is.
Right.
But the idea that you're willing to just look the other way, to me, says a lot. That to me says a lot. And so I think that when you think about an organization like Time's Up, this is also another one of those reasons why people don't like to get involved in politics. Because as we all know, Time's Up is an organization that focuses exclusively, almost, all right, I don't know if it's 100%, but almost exclusively on people in the GOP. This is not supposed to be a partisan issue here. If you are in a position of power and women are being taken advantage of, and we all know what happens on both sides of the aisle, there is no question here that this is a serious problem on both sides. But if your focus is only on one side, then you're not an organization that's actually helping anybody. You're an organization that is taking advantage of vulnerable women for the purpose of political gamesmanship. That is very dangerous. And that is why there are members of this organization that they're trying to bring down right now. Whether it is Anita Dunn, whether it is Hillary Rosen, Lord knows I wouldn't mind seeing Hillary Rosen hit the bricks, but that's just me. She unfortunately is somebody who, if I've ever seen blatant racism in full view of millions of people, and what she did to Nina Turner is about as bad as anything I've ever seen. And the fact that Nina was so gracious in the way that she handled it, I still thought was incredible. I don't know how she didn't explode on her. And if you've never seen the video of Hillary Rosen basically telling her that you have no standing.
To quote Dr. K, this woman.
That's like.
That people will only say because they're not in the same room with you. That would go in the category of things that people feel like empowered to say because they don't have to be standing next to you.
All I can tell you.
Oh, my God. I wanted to jump through and just grab her by the hair. That was crazy.
I love Nina, and I know that she is a woman of exceptional decency, but I don't think if she was in a room with Hillary Rosen, that would end very well for her. just my opinion.
I almost feel like I don't think it would end very well with me. I don't want to be in the same room with someone like that.
When people get accused of, you know, white privilege and things that they do that are really detrimental and harmful to vulnerable people, I think of people like Hillary Rosen. I think of people like Anita Dunn. I think of organizations like that take advantage of the vulnerable. And if there is a circumstance where it's politically opportunistic, like why am I blanking on his name? The Supreme Court justice that you think is a joke. That is a joke.
That you got to be way more specific.
That is a joke.
Amy Coney Island? Brett Kavanaugh?
Brett Kavanaugh. Because Brett Kavanaugh never actually tried a case. I don't even know how that was possible.
I don't think she has either, actually.
Wow, that's it.
I don't think she has either.
What have we done? I mean, listen, our legal system is bad enough to begin with, but what the hell has happened to it?
Don't.
It's like falling off a, it's like off a cliff now. I mean, that is so bad.
I can't even.
The marshal doesn't approve.
No.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And that to me, I think, is really the problem. And I hope that Lucy will want to talk about it, because I still think that a lot of her decision to come forward.
There we go. Much
to do with the reaction of, it's not a big deal.
Oh, okay. No. So it is a very big deal. So let's bring Lucy on, because we obviously didn't. We had a misunderstanding. She went into the Google instead of into. And the truth is, that is something that I would do.
Well, we're going
We're
going through a situation right now where we're trying to figure out our production situation, because it basically is us.
Yeah, we
run the whole operation on our own.
And I am tech challenged, so we have some issues.
I'm really good at following directions, you know? I'm like, if there's a link there and it's in my calendar, I go to it and I'm like patiently just sitting there waiting.
So I don't know if you were listening before you came in, because you weren't in the back. Right. So I preface this with is that when you came forward with your story, or at least when it made news or when I heard about it, I was livid, like beyond. And I had people around me basically saying, it's just Joe. It's just, this is just what, and I'm like, and then I felt almost gaslit for thinking that this was one of the most disgusting. People don't understand that it's a matter of entitlement. It's the entitlement of it. And to not get that was astounding to me. And I can't fathom what you felt like when I felt like I was being gaslit for thinking that this was an outrage. So talk a little bit about, because we know the story, but talk about the repercussions of sharing your story.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that the repercussions are what all women who speak out against any powerful man experience, right? My character was attacked. My motivations were attacked. I mean, every last possible conclusion that anyone could possibly think of was made without my consultation, without input from me, conclusions were drawn. And, you know, bottom line is that you're a terrible, vile human and you're clearly only doing this for attention, right? Like, that's what happens to all women. It's just, it's the MO, it's what happens. And so I was really mentally prepared for all of that. You know, for me, from the very, very beginning, what I said was that yes, it was about talking about behavior that had not been treated with the appropriate response and the seriousness that it deserved, but that it was also that Joe Biden was in a position to actually demonstrate leadership, you know, because it wasn't just him, it's all men. I'm not one, I shouldn't say that, it's not all men. It is the patriarchal system under which we as women have to live in, right? And that we're socialized from a very, very, like the moment we're born, right? And if you look at Cuomo now in the situation where literally the exact same words that Biden said was like, I'm just a friendly guy. I hug people. I kiss them on the cheek, you know? And so my thing was always, you know, it's just so fascinating to see how, unfortunately, so many people on what I call our side will go through these mental gymnastics in order to rationalize behavior that if it were anywhere else, if it were on the Republican side, an opposing side, someone they don't like, someone who's easy to villainize, is easy for them to do. But then when it comes to being introspective and calling out all behavior because it's wrong, period, no matter who does it, that all of a sudden, you know, it's just a completely different situation, completely different standard. So I was prepared for everything that happened. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean that you feel any better about it. You know, it's still really hurtful. I definitely lost personal friends who I thought were friends, but
they were never your friends.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, listen, I've been in politics long enough to understand that already. You know, it's also a really sad commentary on the state of our politics, and especially for women and women of color in politics, that you have to go into it with this expectation that you will be abused, you will be hurt, you will be judged by different standards, and that you just have to be tough about it. You know, instead of actually changing the behavior, we have to change ourselves. We have to develop this armor. We have to become, you know, yeah, these machines essentially with like no feelings, right? So I had been used to, I was already accustomed to it, but I, you know, again, you are a human, and I don't think it ever, you never really stop. The sting never really goes completely.
No, and I just want to touch on something you said where, no, it's not all men, but let me be very clear. And I've said it a million times and I will always say it. I do not know a single adult woman that has not been violated in one form or another along a spectrum. And yes, it's a broad spectrum. You know, I always say ranging from like offensive jokes to like Bill Cosby rape, you know, like there's a spectrum. But I don't know a woman who has not been violated. So to not believe a woman who said she, it's, that to me is the opposite of rational. This is completely reasonable. I don't know a woman who has not been violated. So why would I think somebody would be making that up? Like that's the, and so especially when, you hear it from women, and you do definitely hear it from Democratic women. If you dare say something about the person that they're hoping is just going to, you know, save their, you know, all, solve all their problems. And it's definitely a double, you know, it's a hypocrisy that we just live with all the time. So they're all woke until it affects their politics. But how can any woman question? It's mind boggling to me.
And I can definitely say, as a man, just observing from the outside, and I can attest to this, guys. Men in private will reveal some really insane things about the way they think of women, how they treat them, and think that it's okay. I don't think like that, but I do have friends that do. And if you want to say that they're not friends, that's fine too.
They might be your friends, but they're not my friends.
But I do not approve of that type of behavior. And I speak very direct about it. And Lucy, one of the things that I notice in particular with everything that happened with Cuomo over the past few months is the type of people who were defending him were typically women, typically older
women. It's always women.
And I think that that's an issue that doesn't get talked about enough, about how when we talk about, and again, this was something we saw in 2016, where they used that as a political weapon about, well, women should be protecting women.
Right, yeah, right. There's a special kind of hell for women who don't support other women, unless they don't support your same
candidate.
As long
as it's your political agenda that is going to coincide with it. And so when your political worldview gets hit, the vitriol, the nasty things, because we had Lindsay Boylan on the podcast, and she did talk about the type of responses she got. And then we had Tara Reid on and the responses that she got. And they both said unequivocally, the treatment we received from women compared to men was 10 times worse. If you could speak on that, please.
I think, you know, that very much speaks to other dynamics going on. A couple things. So this is just my observation, and not just in the situation with Biden and his inappropriate behavior, but really just in the political space period, and really anything that entails power and power dynamics. And so there's two things, I think, especially when it comes to older women. One, I think there's a lot of internalized misogyny going on. I think that there's this phenomenon. This happens also with people who break cycles of poverty and like, you know, really get brainwashed into the bootstrap mentality. This happens there too, where basically they kind of look at it like, well, I went through that, I experienced that, I survived, you can too, right? This is no big deal. And so it's a minimization that occurs, because they're like, well, I went through it, I did it, and look at me, I'm fine. You know, you're fine too. Stop making a big deal. You're so sensitive. You're this. And so I think a lot of it just becomes internalized, and it is internalized misogyny. It's that, you know, so many of these women, especially the older ones, that would literally say things like that, like, oh my gosh, she could have just said something, or why didn't she just slap his hand off her back, or, you know, why didn't she just slap him when he kissed her, you know, and all these things, like, why this, why that, when they know damn well that those dynamics are complicated, and that most women, if not probably all women, would not dare do anything like that, right? Like, and it's so easy for them to judge, because again, they have really internalized all of these messages, their own experiences, what they were forced to go through and what they were forced to accept. And now we are in a space where this generation and younger generations are being empowered in such a way where we're saying, we don't have to accept that anymore. This is not Mad Men. This is not the days of 70s backslapping old white man politics. That's not what this is. And we are going to begin to speak out now. We are being empowered to do that. So that's one. The second thing, I think, is that it's really just a matter of power dynamics and adjacency to power. You see this a lot when it comes to white women, especially in how white feminism protects white feminism, right? It protects its own members. And so you will be a woman up until your power structure is threatened. And so voting rights, right? When suffrage movement, when white women were fighting for their right to vote, they were like, listen, black women and native women, y'all are gonna have, you know, we're not even thinking about Mexican women, because, you know, you're over there in the other part of the country. We're not even sure if, you know, what's going on with old Mexico, you know, so it's like, it's all this thing, right? And they're like, we're going to deal with ourselves, because we're the ones that matter, and we don't need you. And that's still that dynamic, right? Is that you have women who, whether it's because of their adjacency to power, like what happened with some of the top people in the Time's Up movement, who were, you know, who got involved in defending Cuomo, and while at the same time running this national organization that supposedly is, you know, an integral part of Me Too, the Me Too movement, and holding men accountable, you know, you have those same women who are turning right back around and advising Cuomo on how best to attack women like Lindsay, right? And so, and that has absolutely nothing, I don't think it has a whole lot to do with internalized misogyny at that point. I think all of it has to do with their adjacency to power.
and the only way in which they can hold on to that power and that influence is by protecting their positions.
Right. And at that point, it's self-serving. Right. At that point, it's just completely self-serving, and that's what, and it would be done for whoever, by whomever was in that position, male or female.
And it's a question of, and it's a question of protecting that, and then it's a question of morals at that point, right? And so I think that you have those two dynamics that are happening all at the same time, and that has happened with women since, you know, since the beginning, and it will, you know, to a certain extent always happen. And again, that same dynamic occurs within Democrats, within, you know, folks that are interested in protecting you know, power structures. And so when it comes to calling out inappropriate things, calling out bad behavior, literally speaking up for supposedly the morals that you have, right, all of a sudden that goes out the window because folks are more interested in those other
not all of us, of course not.
And you know, luckily there are plenty of us who you know, who, that's part of the reason why I'm no longer in politics, right? I had to step away for my own, well, for my own.
Yeah, let's talk about that, like what you're doing now. Like, let's talk about that. Like,
talk
what,
about the Love, Luz Collective.
It's Luz.
I'm a guy. What okay. do I know?
I always say, like, and the thing is about, like, I will walk into a room where people do not speak English and I'll do my best, but essentially it's like, lo siento, soy gringa, and that's it. And he is worse than me. I grew up in Florida and lived in San Antonio for 6 years. So
let me assure you.
He's the worst.
Let me assure you, Duolingo does work.
Not for you.
You just have to be consistent with it.
Oh,
and
God.
I'm not consistent enough.
You know what?
If you started speaking Spanish, I would be able to at least understand part of the conversation.
No, you wouldn't.
Yes, I would. But I wouldn't be able to speak it.
You
so there's that.
She was saying.
I literally was going to say, like, aren't you Florida based?
Okay, but wait, Lucy, your family is Mexican, yes?
Yeah, my family's Mexican.
Okay, so let me say that I understand that dialect infinitely better than Cuban and what we have down here. Well, Venezuelan, yeah, forget.
It's just too fast.
It is. And when I lived in San Antonio, I did infinitely better, even though I grew up here. So I, for some reason, I understand Mexican Spanish. Not great, but better is what I'm.
Well, I mean, same. Mexicans will tell you the same thing. Right. You know, like sometimes we have trouble understanding.
Okay, so you can and then we get Spanish. And we get the Spanglish. I don't know what that is. Like,
yeah, the biggest issue to me is speed. And that particular part of, you know, Latin culture, particularly Cuban and Venezuelan, they speak it so fast. I can't keep up. Mexican is the right pace. If I was only listening to that, I'm sure I'd pick it up.
So where are you from, Lucy?
I'm born and raised. Well, not raised, but born in LA, raised in Vegas. My parents are from Mexico. So I'm second gen. You know, part of the reason why I founded the Luz Collective is specifically because of that. There's so much that we don't know and recognize in mainstream media about the Latino community. The first one being that the vast majority of Latinos in the U.S. actually are English dominant. You know, somewhere around 80.
You mean you're not all the same?
Not all right, exactly.
All Hispanic people aren't the same. I'm just fascinated by it.
Right.
To me,
yeah,
it's an overlooked thing that people assume that people, it's a monolith. No, there's actually a huge difference between Argentinians and Brazilians. Like all of it is very, very different. And I'm definitely Mexican partial, I must say. And it's definitely food related. And
Mexican heritage is the majority of Latinos in the U.S. for sure. It is the largest demographic of Latinos. That being said, you know, there are differences, but there's also so many commonalities that this community has, you know. And so the biggest thing that I found in politics and serving, I was the first Latina elected there. Actually, myself and three of my colleagues were the first Latinas. We were all elected at the same time in 2010. And you can imagine how many years after the state of Nevada joined the union that there was a single Latina elected into that state legislature, right? In a state that was very well on its way to becoming majority Latino. And so the progress that needed to be made and that still needs to be made, a lot of it really started with our lack of understanding of other cultures and our backgrounds, and the fact that the majority in this country tries to paint this homogeny that doesn't exist, right? And so ensuring that we are getting the correct media narratives out there, that there is at least a tiny little bit, just to start, right? A little tiny little bit of understanding of what this culture is, who these people are. It serves all of us better, right? Not just in the political space, but all of us as a country. And so that's really what we're dedicated to. We're dedicated to telling our Latina stories from a Latina perspective in English, as the majority of Latinos understand. And really that our voices, our stories are present in mainstream media.
I think that's great. You know, I was just sitting here thinking about how hilarious it is to me that people so put all Spanish speakers as if it's a monolith, because so, for example, Germany and Italy are connected by a border. They're right next to each other. And yet people don't sit there and say, oh, Germans and Italians, it's all the same thing. But yet you could have, you know, I mean, think about whatever two furthest away countries between South America and Mexico, and you just think that it's all the same thing.
Right.
Like that's just, it's crazy just based on the fact that there's a similar language. I don't know. It's just really funny.
I think that the deliberate, and I think that this is something, Lucy, you could probably speak to, being in politics in a swing state. The corporate media narrative has a huge impact on the way people perceive politics. It's like when you think about, MSNBC and CNN in particular, they refer to the Latino vote as a monolith. It's like, oh, the Latino vote is all the same. And I'm like, no, it isn't. There is a huge difference between West Coast Latino and East Coast Latino.
There's a difference between poor brown Venezuelans and rich white Venezuelans in Weston and what they both stand for. And they live in the same city. So, you know, not all the same.
Can you talk about that experience? Because obviously a lot of things has transpired in the last 5 years. I think there's been sort of this political awakening of sorts. And we'll definitely get to, you know, what's going on in Nevada. But I obviously would love to hear your perspective in terms of how, obviously the Luz Collective is trying to work against that corporate media narrative that is so prevalent in our society.
Right. Correct. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and my perspective also was this, right? I think for all institutions, you have an inside strategy and an outside strategy. And what I mean by that is that sometimes we do need folks on the inside, a Pramila Jayapal, for example, others who are kind of like, all right, let's work this system from the inside, make as much progress as we can, while of course trying to hold on to the values as much as possible. And then you kind of have an outside perspective, those who we might consider like the agitators, the people who are willing to take the arrows, knowing that if they do that, it is going to be almost impossible to pass any legislation, right? And so that we need both of those people, right? You need folks that are within the structure.
An inside outside strategy.
Right. And people who are building their own structures in order to be able to dismantle and rebuild that system, right? That exists in media as well. And what I recognized very early on in my political career was that I did not have the patience to do the inside game. Didn't have it, right? Like I could have done it. I was certainly smart enough. I was an incredibly good policymaker. In fact, I was one of the, actually I think the statistic is the most effective policymakers under a Republican governor in my time in service, right? So I knew how to work the system. It was just a matter of how long I was willing to tolerate it. And I couldn't tolerate it for very long. I just got so exhausted from fighting my own people more than I was fighting my opposing party.
That it sounds like me. You can't even, like, I've said this so many times to him. This is ridiculous. It's exhausting.
It is exhausting. It's so exhausting. And, you know, when you're someone who your sole purpose to be there is to achieve some semblance of change, to make things at least marginally better for people because that's what you were elected to do. You're not there to be a party loyalist. You're not there to be a party cheerleader. You're not there to be any of those things. You're there to try to improve the lives of as many people as you possibly can. And for me to have to sit there and, you know, kind of play these games, if you will, and keep your mouth shut because you know that you need that chairmanship in the next cycle and all of these other things that go with it. Frankly, I just did not have the personality, the patience to deal with it. And so I did end up running for different offices where, you know, I didn't necessarily have like the oversight of my leadership and that those kinds of things. The Democratic Party, of course, did everything to defeat me, which they eventually did. And so that is, I mention all of that because that is the approach that I also take it to the media space. And it's an approach that's necessary in the media space too. I very easily, in fact, I was on a different panel discussion earlier today about why I decided to actually build my own media entity as opposed to going and joining, you know, a mainstream entity, whether it was in the news space or whether it was in, you know, digital entertainment or whatever it was. And literally the biggest reason is the same reason why I did not stay within the, you know, with the legislative body in Nevada is because I, again, was not willing to go into an institution and play those games in order to achieve, you know, a modicum of progress. Instead, I'm just going to be like, you know what, screw it. I'm going to go out and build my own. Because that's the kind of I'm willing to play the outside game. That's the game that I'm dedicated to. That game in many ways is a lot harder, right? Like trying to not only maintain that, but build things from scratch. You're still fighting those same institutional barriers, only in different ways. It's hard, you know, and it is exhausting. But I also think, you know, it's on your own terms, it's for your reasons. And you know, it's you're only limited by the effort that you're willing to put into it. I mean, obviously not taking into account, of course, all the institutional stuff that we're talking about, but you get what I'm saying. You know, like you're determining what it is that you're going to do as opposed to someone else telling you, no, you're not going to be doing that today, or this isn't the way we do it, or that's not the way that it's done, et cetera. You create whatever it is that you're going to create. And I love that. I love that. And that's what we do at Loose. And, you know, we are producing these stories and telling and showcasing our community and disrupting narratives and disrupting stereotypes. And hopefully, you know, like I said,
where can people follow? Like, as most of this is, it's digital, right? I mean, everything that you're talking about is digital. It's a variety of different genres, though. Is that correct? Yes. Like, there's a few different things. So, did you put the website
up?
Yes,
I did.
Okay.
I'll put it up again.
So, explain like the kind of content that you have there, like who you're showcasing and the different varieties of stuff that's on there.
So, we're literally showcasing all kinds of different stories, all kinds of different issues that matter to not only just the Latinx community, but the community at large, right? I mean, the really wonderful thing about media is that stories are universal. You know, we have no problem. I have no problem going to a movie or watching a media newscast or whatever the case is and seeing an all white cast or an all male panel, right? We're so used to seeing these things that we don't even question whether or not that we find that entertaining or we find that interesting. It is the exact same concept when you talk about Black media or Latino media or Asian media, et cetera, right? The stories that we're telling, yes, are for the purpose of highlighting and centering Latina voices and Latina perspectives and experiences. But in terms of who our target audience is, first it is the Latinx community, but it's also the community at large, right? Because we know that the content that we're producing is going to be interesting not only to us, but to everybody else as well. So it could be about, you know, women doing amazing things in entrepreneurship. It can be stories of new musical artists. It can be breaking news about whatever topic is affecting or centers a Latina or a Latino in that particular thing that happened, you know. we do a lot of advocacy in terms of uplifting stories that maybe wouldn't otherwise be paid attention to. For example, the young woman who was murdered on base in Texas, and all of the advocacy that occurred when, again, mainstream media wasn't picking up on the various things that are happening to our communities. So it's, you know, it's a lot of variety, but it really just, the whole point is that it's centering these stories, and giving it from, and telling, creating that content from an authentic and culturally appropriate perspective.
Do you, have you all addressed, like what is going on at our border? The, obviously the immigration issue is massive. And it's really more pathetic that people are being used as political pawns. But usually what runs through my mind is from a very female perspective, where I'm thinking of, and I think about this all the time, wherever part of the world it is, that these are just, like I could cry. These are just mothers trying to get their babies from point A to point B without getting killed. That's it. That's all they're trying to do. And like, it's very, like it's gut wrenching to me, a lot of this stuff. And I would think that this is, especially when you're talking about, in the Southwest, that this is probably a pretty pressing issue. And there are women whose experiences I can't even fathom. But well, I was wondering if you touch on that.
Yeah. So for example, you know, every week what we do is on our Instagram, that's the Loose Collective on Instagram. We produce something called the Loose of the Week, and it's just a little roundup of the three top stories that we think are worthy and are interesting to our community. And so the three top stories from this week, I'll give you the three headlines. The first one is Airbnb to give housing to refugees. The second one is Biden's administration keeps ruthless migrant policies. And the third one is the FDA granted Pfizer full approval.
Okay, so clearly you're addressing immigration issue. I mean, I would think so, just based on the fact that I would think that you would, but yeah, I'm glad.
Well,
to
and
hear
we
that.
Also cover politics from a very, very. I wouldn't say a nonpartisan. It is nonpartisan, but it is more from a. I tell people very simply, this is the perspective that we take, because we are a for-profit media company. We're not a nonprofit. So the perspective that we take is this: we are for you if you are for us, period. So in terms of advocating for certain elected officials or highlighting the various things that they're doing, et cetera, we will encourage folks to vote. We will often sometimes encourage, we don't, you know, quote unquote endorse, but we certainly encourage people. And we did encourage people to vote for Biden. Because the alternative was not something that the Latino community in particular could bear any longer. I mean, that's really what the brunt of it was for everybody, right? But in terms of the perspective that we take is that I tell people, show me a Republican who's for us and I'll be more than happy to highlight them. But also when Democrats are not doing the right thing, when they're, as that headline says, maintaining a ruthless migrant policy, because we use those same words for Trump, so therefore we're going to use those same words for Biden, right? We're not sugarcoating any of the coverage that we produce for Democrats, because Latinos are often associated with being pro-Democrat. We are pro-people who are pro-us, period.
Yeah, I think that that's true. We've seen, especially here, even just the division amongst the Cuban population, blue versus red is ridiculous. But, you know, we generally see that there's slightly kinderness on the left, slightly. And interestingly that you say that you ended up endorsing Biden, because I was on the fence for a long time as to what to do about that. And I ultimately did vote for him. And I always remind myself that if anything else, if I did nothing else, that the DACA kids were able to sleep better. And that was it. Like that. And if that's it, then okay. You know, like then it was worth it. But that's all I really give myself.
Our bar is so low.
We have a very low bar.
You know, it's like when the whole nation is now paying attention to Governor DeSantis, we try to remind them, yeah, he's bad, but We had Governor Rick Scott for 8 years. So it could always be worse, especially in this state. And I think this is, and it's a great segue to, I think, what will probably be our last topic, which of course leads to what you were just talking about. We believe that our future as a movement, as a, you want to call it a progressive movement?
No.
I think it's broader than that.
I hate that.
So I think that word's been co-opted in many ways. But we focus on a non-corporate, non-partisan labor movement.
And really justice. I mean, it's about justice, but we think that labor is the path to uniting the most amount of people politically.
A lot has changed since Roberta Lang slammed that gavel down in 2016. The state has obviously taken on sort of a new identity. We saw what happened with the non-corporate takeover of the state party. Where would you say?
I want to know what she's going to. Why she's laughing? Because we had a situation here.
We did, and so I want to hear from you, who knows the ins and outs of what goes on in Carson City, what goes on in Vegas that people don't know about. From the outside looking in, people think
what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Don't talk about Vegas.
That may be true, but we would love to hear from you about the dynamics, the evolution of Nevada politics.
Talk about that progressive takeover, will you?
Well, I laugh because the very first thing, controversial thing that happened when the new chair took over from the progressive wing, if that's what we're calling it, was that the state party emptied their bank accounts before they were able to take over. So they literally, and they left them with $0, right? Or at least as close to zero as they could possibly get it, right? They're like, okay, you want the party? You're going to have to raise your own money. And I was like, oh my gosh, that is totally par for the course for Democrats in Nevada. Like, I wasn't surprised even for a second that the first thing they would do is do all the machinations and be like, boop, 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 empty, zero, you get nada. Because it's not about party, and it's not about achieving our party platform and electing the best people. It is about protecting the power structure in Nevada. It's always been that way. I don't know how long it's going to be that way. I think that there is just, and for a long time under Obama, because he destabilized the party structure and he tried to kind of build his own with OFA and everything that happened there, and starved the parties of money and resources and support that they needed. I mean, it just created this vacuum. The politicians took over, and getting that back in many states, including Nevada, Florida is very similar, was just, it's going to take decades to reverse all of that damage. And because, at the end of the day, because of how much money, and, this is one of the reasons why I was a Bernie supporter very early on, is because I said to myself when the Supreme Court decision around Citizens United came down, I said, this is literally the beginning of the decline. And it was, right? The everyday voter, I tell people all the time, they have, and so I do empathize with them because they have no idea they're being manipulated. They don't. They don't know that between all the dark money and between all of the messaging that they're being bombarded with, they really don't have any idea that this Democrat that is using the progressive label and as being backed by all of these power structures, sometimes including labor as well, because labor is very much in that institutional democratic establishment structure in Nevada. Like, it's
difference between management, labor bosses, and rank and file, huge distinction.
Massive difference.
Yeah. So I just
we weren't gonna touch.
We don't need to go there, but
I think it's important to point out that the one thing that we do talk about when it comes to Wasserman Schultz is the fact that her biggest protector in Broward County is Dan Reynolds, the head of the Broward County AFL-CIO, which connects all of the unions. And a person who we will not name, but is in a powerful union, is a huge supporter of Jen's. And the only reason why they were not able to endorse, and this endorsement would probably change the dynamic of her running a second time, the fact that this guy pulls the strings.
Right. And that is not what is in the best interest of labor. So those are very different things.
Right. And so my point in bringing all of that up is that it's really going to take a lot of time, but a lot of really dedicated, smart people to begin to rebuild our parties in a way that actually is true to our values, supposedly our stated values, and our platforms that we've adopted, right? Because everyone says that they're for those things, but then when it comes down to actually doing it, the legislative process, standing up against big interests, et cetera, all of that goes out the window, right? And so we have to acknowledge that these are very powerful forces within our political institution. And frankly, if we don't get a handle on these, I oftentimes, tell people I have an exit plan, a long-term exit plan. In fact, I just got back from Mexico. I was there for 7 months.
Oh, wow.
I needed a break from this country. I did. After Biden won, I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it, to be honest. And my dad had just passed, and it was just so much going on that I was like, I have to get out of this country.
Where did you go, though? Where in Mexico were you?
In Playa del Carmen. In Playa del Carmen.
Oh, of course I know where that is. So you were on vacation.
I was on a healing journey is what
I was. Okay, so I was going to say that's very healing.
Yeah, it was. It was exactly what I needed. But I when I came back to the US, Mexico is broken in many ways as well, and they've got their amazing fair share of problems. But I will say that the callousness that exists in the United States right now, the level of selfishness, the toxicity, the racism, you feel it in this country. And then to see our own people, to see our leaders really becoming a part or being a part of maintaining this status quo, it's heavy, it's heavy. And, someone is saying that, they need a healing journey too. We have to take that for ourselves. And so I very much empathize with any activist, first and foremost, anywhere, any Democratic activist, anyone who is fighting against the status quo, certainly those who are in leadership positions right now, but then also our everyday folks who are just trying to do what they can, especially in places like Nevada. Imagine taking over the state party only to the very first thing that they do is empty out the bank accounts. Can you imagine? And it's all fun and games for them, right? Like they're just protecting their power and doing what they have to do. Nobody notices, right? Like the everyday person doesn't pay attention enough to recognize that this is a part of their manipulation. So yeah, it's an uphill battle, but I do think that it's an uphill battle that lots and lots of people are dedicated to fighting.
We absolutely support, Amy Vilela, and we certainly think that a representative like her would definitely make a difference, especially for the people of Vegas. And her story is absolutely heartbreaking. I don't know how, anytime you have to bury your child is obviously something that you can't even fathom, but having to do it based on the fact that we have the most destructive healthcare system in the world is something that, again, I can't even imagine how she holds it together. But the fact that there is this sort of this uprising, this desire for change, I think is a huge deal. And I'm wondering, if you wanted to put your thinking cap on, because this is something that, especially for the, for the Loose Collective and hearing like how you would let's say, direct somebody like AOC, because a lot of people look at her as this amazing leader, but there's also a lot who don't think that she does enough. What I think is the missing ingredient right now with her is the fact that there isn't a big enough outside movement basically learning from what she has been able to accomplish and then taking the natural next step. Having the people in the streets, barking down her door at her office is not the answer, but taking the initiative to say, all right, she did this. She is obviously doing what she feels she needs to do, but there must be an outside strategy to work alongside what she needs to be doing on the inside. So I just kind of thought of that at random, but I thought this might be right in your wheelhouse for what your organization does. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, I think that what we can continue to do, and particularly at my company, is that we can continue to shine the light, the loose, on the information that's needed so that people understand not only what that experience is like, but also what are the actual barriers and processes that she is having to experience and go through. I think so much of it's so, there's just such a lack of understanding of what our process is actually like versus the old how a bill becomes a law cartoon that we all remember, right? Like, and so it's very easy for people to judge and to say, she's not doing enough. She's not challenging the speaker enough. She's not doing X. She's not doing Y. The squad is not, you know, they suck, or whatever they're saying about them, right? And literally not take it a step further to try to understand what exactly is it that they need in order to be able to push legislation.
Exactly. Right.
That's part of, unfortunately, what they are all now trying to explain. And this is actually a really great idea, because I think, you know, this actually might be a really great story to produce. So thanks. Like, I have a new editorial pitch.
Well, you know, what's interesting is
I have a few good ideas here.
No, what's interesting is when we were talking about way back about the force the vote issue, I remember thinking, yes, it's not a bad idea, but the way it needed to be done was needed to be working with them while they're on the inside and saying, look, we have support. We have your back out here. This is how we should do this. Instead of attacking them, you could have worked with them. And so I think that is an example of where those two sides could almost be in and out.
Look, I think that there's not enough political analysis for the progressive left, the way that there's political analysis for the center, for moderates and center right Democratic space, right? Like, there's not enough political pundits out there and political analysis reaching the mainstream and reaching, frankly,
mainstream.
Right. Because sometimes a force the vote would be appropriate if it made strategic sense, right? When you want, and we've done this before, you know, where you pass a bill, for example, normally it's done with the opposing side, where you pass a bill because you want to get their no votes on record. But you get their no votes on record because then you have a plan to follow up after that. If you're forcing a vote just to have Pelosi or somebody else or moderate Democrats to say no, then what are we accomplishing with that? Is that no vote going to then support a candidate that is running against her to then take that seat so that we can replace her with a progressive person? If the answer is no, then what the hell are we wasting our energy on and attacking these people who don't deserve the attack, criticizing them on why they wouldn't do a force the vote strategy, right?
And without naming names, we all know who you're referring to. This is the thing that him and his group of minions don't seem to understand, and you would definitely understand being in the state legislature. Relationships are everything, even with people you don't agree with politically, because if you have a good relationship with them, you'd be amazed at what you can accomplish.
You mean burning bridges left and right, and cursing people out and belligerent rants?
If you
want to
throw the body out with the, if you want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, see how far that gets you. But there is one thing that I do want to do before you go, which I think is very important.
Oh my God.
Lucy, I just want to say, I really appreciate you. You've done amazing work out in Nevada. And what we accomplished in 2020 after what happened in 2016 was nothing short of spectacular. It was really incredible. Could have been a nominee.
Are you going to endorse Amy?
I already endorsed Amy.
You did? Okay, I'm just asking. Okay.
But if you want to know what a great organization is all about, you definitely want to go to the losecollective.com. It's a great place. Lucy is doing amazing work out in Nevada and will do amazing work for you anywhere in the United States. So if you're looking for a great opportunity, please give her a call.
This is our life.
I've had people say that. I've had people tell me that's their. They haven't heard a better Bernie. I'm like,
no, you're really great, Bernie. Can I just say really fast that I have actually worked with Bernie personally a lot,
right?
And I literally felt like I was talking to Bernie.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Like, if I closed my eyes, I'd be like, "That's Bernie."
We're both from Brooklyn, so I kind of have. I was raised in Jersey, so I kind of just have that accent down. Like,
I know. I think he has actually said those words about me before. So that was amazing. That was actually very, very good.
We would absolutely, unequivocally love to have you back again. This has been a great conversation.
Where are you in Nevada, Lucy? Where do you live?
So I actually am no longer in Las Vegas, although Nevada is definitely, Las Vegas is my home. Like I said, I've been living everywhere for the last year and a half. I moved back to Vegas back in September. My dad passed in October and it was a really tough time. And so that's when I decided to go back home. And then after that, I left to Mexico, and now I've just been back and forth, just kind of nomading around. I'm actually in Phoenix right now. So I was
just Vegas is home base. Is Vegas.
So Vegas is home base. And then I'm in LA part-time, but I might be in your city soon, so maybe we could do this in person.
We could definitely hang out.
Well, the last time I was in Arizona, I did get to experience Sedona for a day, so that was a great experience.
I was I was in Sedona on my 30th birthday. I needed to be at it's the spiritual vortex of the universe, or so I was told,
Well, it's definitely
Sedona does have, I feel like, some very healing.
It does.
Energy. It's one of the most beautiful places in the country.
For sure.
I recommend it.
Guys, Lucy Flores, The Lose Collective, highly recommend you check it out. Recommend to anybody, especially in the Latino community, that you think could benefit from being involved with an amazing leader, somebody who really has done an amazing job to this point and really put herself out there for a lot of people who feel like they don't have a voice. So needless to say, we are very grateful to have had you on, and we hope to see you again soon.
Thank you so much, Lucy. It was so nice to meet you.
And next time it'll be much smoother because now we have all the instructions.
Right.
That's true.
Bye, Lucy.
Bye, Lucy. Bye.
Well, that was wonderful.
She's adorable.
Yeah, she knows. Listen, she's anybody who is willing to do what she was willing to do, knowing the great risk that she took and was still willing to do it anyway.
Seriously, kudos for that. But, and also because of Lucy and what happened to her and the crap that she got was what inspired Tara to come forward with her story.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.